You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast.
Number 176, The Future of Learning Platforms by Phil Hill. Rod Murray. Welcome back to my podcast. Well, that short teaser was from a song called There's Nothing Impossible by Deus, a techno-classical musician from the Ivory Coast. I've always been fond of electronic music, and this one caught my ear a while ago. So I hope you enjoy it. I'll play the full song at the end of my podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all of the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. Well, this special audio and video podcast is a rebroadcast of Phil Hill's keynote entitled The Future of Learning Platforms. Phil's a publisher of the Phil on EdTech blog, and a partner at MindWires, LLC. As a market analyst, Phil has analyzed the growth of technology-enabled change for educational institutions. If you're listening to this podcast and reading Inside Higher Ed, you really need to know Phil Hill. He knows about all there is to know about the learning management companies and certainly all kinds of learning platforms and its effect on higher ed. He gave the keynote at the U-Sciences eLearning 3.0 conference this past May 14th at the University of the Sciences, my home base. By the way, I think our conference on May 14th really hit the mark, and thanks to Phil Hill, we had almost 200 attendees from over 60 area institutions, and including not just the tri-state area here near Philadelphia, but we had attendees from Canada, California, Boston, and so on. So you can go to my show notes and make sure you sign up for the mailing list for next year's conference. Now back to today's topic. Phil discusses the LMS market share, LMS as a walled garden, the chasm between visionaries and pragmatists, transformation of MOOCs, new platform designs, moving beyond the digitization of traditional classrooms, personalized learning, machine learning, and student data. So without further ado, here's the keynote by Phil Hill.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction and for the invitation to speak here today. And it looks like a fascinating conference that I've been looking around. As we, with the introduction saying that I'm knowledgeable about the industry, I have to admit that this is not an industry that I necessarily sought out or planned to get into. Not many people say, hey, Mom, I want to grow up to become a consultant or a market analyst. But being a lifelong learner, I certainly believe in this. And the way I got into it is during the dot-com era, I was part of an embedded software company. And I tried to force a takeover by management. And one of the lifelong lessons I learned is if you actually do a hostile takeover and it fails, you don't tend to keep your job. So an important lesson for people. But that's how I sort of fell into educational technology and into this field. And one of the first clients that I worked with in higher education, it was a national for-profit chain, and they called me to help them select a course management system. So I had to figure out, well, what is a course management system? That's what they were known as back then. And as I started digging in, I realized this is a strange area that's very different than a lot of other markets, including the fact that they were calling to ask for help selecting between two systems. Then I even discovered, well, why do you need a consultant for this? Well, we tried last year and we failed, so we still have multiple systems. So it was like, it's strange to me. So it takes 2 years to pick between two different systems. You know, what is this market or what are the issues? A lot of what I learned is just how much it's driven by learning itself and by education. This is not an easy industry because we're touching on how students learn. A second client was a regional research. It was a regional Midwest region research university. Same thing, trying to pick between two different systems, couldn't do it, hit their heads against the wall. It was interesting. But as I started digging into why is this industry weird, so weird, and why is it so challenging, and why do these platforms have such a big stake in what schools are doing? And keep in mind, this was 15 years ago, before we'd really advanced so much with online learning and other strategic initiatives. And as I looked at it, one of the things I noticed, as I've described it, is the LMS, that as it became to be known, could almost be thought of as the minivan of education. Because everybody's got one, but nobody's really proud about it. Nobody sits back and gets excited about their learning management system. Yet they're really important. And part of what happens is you have to admit that there's just a lot of things you can do with a minivan, in this case, that you couldn't do without it. I mean, it just has space. It helped save marriages. I mean, no longer did we have arguments, my wife and I, about how much to pack and how to put in the kids' car seats and how to go on vacation. These are not our kids. But it's been an interesting field. And despite the fact they're not that popular in a lot of times, they're very useful. Of course, we've had our missteps as a lot of features have been bolted on that systems weren't necessarily designed for. And there's a lot of analogies there, both with the minivan, although you don't see this too often, and with learning platforms or LMSs moving forward. But as we stand today, of course, what matters is where are they going in the future? How do they support our online, our hybrid, our face-to-face education? How do they support the strategic initiatives of your institution moving forward? I would argue that learning platforms in this sense are sort of unique when you compare them to other types of platforms, and that you really, the best way to see what's happening in the future is to make sure you understand how we got here in the first place, that you understand the dynamics that have driven us, rather than just saying, hey, here's a new shiny thing, let's look at that, that's going to take over and move us forward. So one of the things that I've worked with, actually started this back in 2008, is I was trying to get clients to not look at this type of decision-making as one of counting 200, 300 features and scoring them and then using that to select the systems. I was trying to say, no, you've got to see the big picture. So came up with what is known as the squid diagram. A lot of people have, looked at that and thought they see a squid. But this basically, the intention of this, and you can download it so you can see the details, is intended to show that if you look in higher education, this is for North America in this case, and if you look at the history of the market in one view, that's what we're trying to do with this. We say, so let's go from the late 90s all the way to present, and let's look at the main systems that have demonstrated they can be institution-wide LMSs supporting an entire institution. And then the thickness of each band, it deals with relative market share. So think of it as the percentage of institutions in the U.S. and Canada using a particular platform at any one time. And we have, the down on the bottom going from 97 through today. The thing that's the most obvious within this graphic is the fact that there's only a handful of systems. We're not talking about a market where we have dozens and dozens of systems to choose from. It's not at all like the corporate learning platform market, where you really do have dozens of systems. And part of that also gets to the issue of you can come up with an RFP that's got hundreds of different feature requirements. You can do that all you want. However, there are not that many systems you can pick from. It's much more important to say which company and which system align best with where we're trying to go as an institution, and how, but not just the platform, but even the company culture, and you're picking a partner moving forward. So one of the first things is noticing there are really only a handful of systems that have demonstrated that they can do institution-wide LMS over time. Now, there's a lot of secondary systems, and that's changing, but I wanted to show primary here. The other thing is the fact, if you look at the origins, the boxes on the left side, if you download it, you'll be able to see, shows that most of these systems actually started out with university projects themselves. So this is not a market where people had venture funding from the beginning, created systems, and then they found a market. This was much more one where individual colleges and projects at colleges created systems, then they got expanded to become commercial platforms that they could sell to multiple schools. And part of that is a lot of them weren't initially designed to be enterprise class. And what I mean by that is mission critical. These systems can't go down during the first week of class or during finals. So we've had a lot of struggles in that area. And then there are other portions of this, but the other thing that's sort of obvious from this chart, and it certainly was one of the early, much more important back in the late 2000s, was the dominance of Blackboard in terms of not just the company, but in terms of the mergers and acquisitions. They had acquired a lot of their competitors, which sort of got subsumed. So that drove a lot of the industry as far as, hey, do we have independent choice, or if we have a system, will it be purchased? Now, Blackboard's changed significantly as a company, new owners, and they are not acting the same way. But the point is, this chart has been used where we're trying to get people to look at a holistic picture of what learning management systems are and where they're going. And the final piece with this is you also get into issues such as open source or not open source, but also the increasing importance of these systems. Because there have been, if you use these systems 10 years ago, 15 years ago, so many of the schools, it's just a handful of places where it's getting used, individual departments, or it was sort of experimental, whereas it's become really mission critical. It is the place from a virtual standpoint where students experience the virtual university that you're part of. And when I say virtual, that includes purely face-to-face programs. This is where students really, really are involved and see what your courses are, and it's really their front door and experience that's become very important. Now, as we go through this, the world has changed underneath learning platforms. When these first came out, and if you looked at this is sort of an idea of free web-based apps that could be used in the classroom. Initially, there were really just a handful of them. You had similar numbers of LMSs, but you had just like Blogger, Google. You had a few web tools. Well, if you fast forward to today, that's completely different. Now, instructors and course designers just have a wealth of platforms and tools they can use within the classroom. And so the environment that these learning management systems work in has changed around them. And that's an important understanding as far as where we're actually going and what's important for these learning platforms. They have to integrate. They have to make it seamless to try different tools. And in fact, that's where a lot of the innovation comes, is how these different tools are patched together for individual solutions. And the way the industry seems to have dealt with this is the initial design, and a lot of people have criticized learning platforms as being walled gardens. And the idea is, okay, let's create an online environment for your courses. Let's have announcements, email, discussion forums, assignments. You have these basic things, grade books, of course, the syllabus. So you have these things, but it's initially these platforms were designed as a walled garden. Everything that you need is provided here. But with the proliferation of these other tools, there's been a lot of pressure where people are saying, wait, we want more. Now, the initial reaction to the industry is you start seeing social networks or blogs coming along. So the initial solution on how to deal with that is to say, well, why don't we actually take a crappy version of these external tools and put it within the LMS itself? And so anytime there was an external tool that got developed, wikis and whatever, you would get these poor versions within the LMS itself. that led to a lot of feature bloat and a lot of people complaining, hey, we have systems that just, they're not usable. It's got so much stuff. None of it's quite as good as what I can do outside of the system. And it led to a lot of frustration. So the market really got to a point where there was just a lot of disappointment. It wasn't going that where people needed it to go. These days, things have changed. There have been tremendous improvements in terms of reliability and quite often with cloud hosting, but also an acknowledgement of, hey, let's actually focus on ease of design, ease of use of a system. Let's design so that they're much easier to use moving forward. And that sort of led to the idea of breaking down the walled garden and trying to say, well, there are core features within a learning platform that everybody needs to use, or at least it has to be available. But we've got to find a way to actually integrate with third-party tools that will make these platforms more usable and will lead to a lot more innovation at the individual course level or individual program level. And one of the greatest ways that this has been done is with the IMS Global, which is a standards body that has put out, and I'm not sure how many people are familiar or have heard of Learning Tools Interoperability or the LTI. Okay, so quite a few of you. That standard really was a breakthrough. It's not the only thing that's involved in this new world of opening up platforms, but in my mind, it really was the thing that changed standards from something dry and only impacting the IT organization and detailed technical usage. And it actually made it to where choosing different applications and integrating them can be done much more on a user type basis. That doesn't mean that schools necessarily let anybody put on a third-party integration, but it's pushing us down that path to say, hey, this should be much more user-driven on what's actually needed. So if you look at the LMS of today, quite often now, the question is, how well do these platforms allow this type of open ecosystem approach? And a lot of that is actually driven by your school's culture. Some schools, particularly if you have a competency-based education program, in those cases, there's a lot of arguments for saying, let's minimize the amount of third-party applications. We're going CBE, we need to design it in a way that you still want to keep somewhat of that walled garden. In that case, do you have enough of the features and the mastery learning and the different things to be able to provide that? Research universities quite often are the opposite, where you say, okay, we have such a wide variety of usage and we have different departments, different disciplines doing things so many different ways. There's no way we can actually control what everybody's doing and what they actually need. So a key for a lot of schools is saying, we don't know centrally. We need to enable individual departments and colleges to figure out different integrations they do, and they really open up this data. Now, it's not just data. People are trying to get past, not just logins. People are now much more interested in saying, well, what about data? If our students are doing some activities here, some activities in another area, how do we actually start collecting that together so we have more of a holistic view of learning and what's going on within the system? And so the ways that platforms and schools actually support these integration standards is a huge driver of what's already happening today, but what's going to be happening in the future. Now, this is part of the reason when I said these are unique platforms and very different than a lot of other systems that you see within education and certainly that you see in corporate America, gets to the issue of the depth of adoption. What this chart is looking at, and I think most of you guys know this intuitively, this is a paper that was done, I believe it was the University of North Texas, and they looked at faculty usage of their learning platforms. And as you can see at the top, that's student adoption. And students, the vast majority of students have used LMSs and are very comfortable using them simply by the fact that they've spread their experience over multiple courses and they're more naturally comfortable for a long time. So at the institution and at the student level, we've had, you know, the majority of people or schools using LMSs for over a decade, really. The difference is that faculty adoption is followed a very different line. And what you see here is there's, you know, it's been lagging, and it's only recent where faculty adoption at many schools that they're consistently using learning platforms moving forward. Now, in this case, I'm not quite sure what the drop is on the last year. There's probably an interesting story why it's dropped in the past year. But in any case, you've now got faculty adoption becoming very mainstream. And this, just because you had systems before, didn't mean that all the courses actually use them. Another interesting variable is the depth of usage. If you're using a platform, are you just like putting your syllabus out there and your grade book, or are you actually using more and more of the system functionality or not? And this is significant in my mind and where we're going, much more so than just the individual numbers. What I think we're getting into is, this is from Everett Rogers initially. He was a sociologist at Iowa State University. He had been looking at the classic book is Diffusion of Innovations. And his initial study, a lot of it was based on the question of why is it that certain innovations get adopted in certain cultures, but in other cultures it doesn't. And so he was looking at quite often in South America, villages adopting clean water habits, where in these cases it was a clear-cut innovation, you know, boil your water, reduce disease, etc. And certain places adopted, certain didn't. That led to a number of discoveries, but the impact on technology is when you hear about the adoption curve, technology adoption curve, and dealing with different groups like innovators, early adopters, majority, and laggards. These groups came out of that research because it really was saying so much of what happens with a technology or an innovation depends on the human element of how these systems are used. And it depends on people's perceived usage of the systems and their characteristics. If you look at early adopters, well, one thing that you find out is early adopters and innovators, they don't need a whole solution. These are the people, if you're looking at faculty, for example, would be saying, all right, listen, I want to use this new tool within my course. Don't hold me back. Don't make me just use the LMS. I've got some other cool things I want to do. And quite often the solution comes down to, you know, well, there's not a whole solution. Well, I'll figure it out myself. I'll come up with an Excel spreadsheet that ties these things together and I'll make it work for my class. That's very typical of this early adopter type of view, where they don't need a whole solution that's safe. However, on the majority side, the characteristics of people who are sort of in the majority is much more conservative in nature. It's much more a view of, okay, I'll use a system if I need to. You know, there's institutional policy or departmental policy, but it better work. If you're going to make me use this system, then you better make sure that it doesn't go down. You better make sure that I can understand what it is. You better make sure that, you know, things are reliable and are going to be there. So this got expanded, and what you see within this chart is the chasm. That was something added by Jeffrey Moore, where he was basically saying, of these different types of people, and these are not immutable characteristics. You might be an early adopter in certain cases, but a laggard in some other type of technology. But he said, this is not a smooth transition. What you really have is you have a huge chasm between the left side of the curve and the right side of the curve. And what you have is the people who are innovators and early adopters, typically 15-20% of your population, they have very unique characteristics that are completely different than everybody else. And so this chasm means it's difficult to sort of hop from one side to the other. It's very difficult for product companies to be able to say, hey, we've got a product that your early adopters are trying things out, and then we're going to get mainstream adoption past that. This is where so many companies fail, but it's also where a lot of e-learning initiatives fail, is not understanding these difference in these groups. This gets back to why this chart is so important. LMS adoption is so deep into the mainstream, it creates a lot of these tensions that schools are having to deal with. Now you have to deal with both sides, and it leads you to what I would call straddling the chasm. Is support staff probably feel it most acutely, but so do product companies. A number of people deal with this. We no longer have the choice, at least in this world of LMSs, to be able to say, hey, I'm serving the early adopters. I'm going to give you all the gee whiz new capabilities, tons of integration points, and just the leading edge capabilities. Because we're now to the point, you also have a wide variety of people where it's like, just give me the system, make sure it works. And so you can't choose one side or the other of this chasm. You actually have to support both sides. The ed tech enthusiasts who are going to go off and try things that are going to be pushing the edge on the privacy level, on the will it work, is it repeatable, pushing the edge on will this company be around next year, that we're using to integrate pieces together. And at the same time, we've got to respect and support the people who are in the mainstream that need to have guardrails, that need to have very safe systems. So this is sort of the place we find ourselves today with learning platforms and education, is we've gotten to the place now where they're widely adopted, they're in the mainstream, we've got this struggle on how do you deal with both sides of the chasm. We have platforms that now have much more standards-based integrations, and so that's where we are today. And so that gets back to my core argument. Understanding this will give us a much better idea of what's going to be happening with these platforms in the future than looking at too much of the activity of brand new companies and radical new ideas. This can be frustrating. It also explains why you might see whole new developments that come out. The LMS is going to be dead. I mean, how long have I been reading that the LMS is the past, it's going to go away? I remember this back from the mid-2000s. People said, okay, we're moving past the LMS. It doesn't support learning. It really is just managing the course. It's obsolete. And then we got into data issues. And one of the problems is, we were having this conversation at a dinner last night. People are very fascinated with data and learning analytics right now, but it's not new. If you had gone to, I remember going to Blackboard World, WebCT's Users Conference, although I can't remember the name of what their Users Conference used to be. But if you went to this back in the mid-2000s, there was a year or two where you would have thought that these were outcomes assessment companies who also happened to sell an LMS on the side. I mean, we went all in, like, we have the solution to data. And this was over 10 years ago. That turned out to be inaccurate, that we were ready for it. And it inaccurate both in terms of product capabilities, but also in terms of institutional maturity to be able to deliver data to systems, or even if they actually saw data coming back, knowing what to do about it. Just the market was, by and large, was not ready. So we've had, I can remember that from 12 years ago. Anybody else actually been to conferences back in the mid-2000s, saw the outcomes assessment tools and what they were pushing? So we have, a couple of people have seen this. Now, if you fast forward, there was almost like the next generation of learning analytics and data within learning platforms. And so that came about. But as it started coming about in 2011, 12, we started then talking about a different version of it. And quite often it got into predictive analytics and artificial intelligence. And I've been seeing for years now the promise of these systems, and it's just not happening. That doesn't mean that there's no value in data, but we need to acknowledge we have not benefited from data coming from the usage of platforms truly helping how we do the teaching and learning mission, or even at the departmental level of understanding all of the data and making use of it to improve our student outcomes. We have a lot of individual cases of it. We have a lot of benefits here and there, but it's not been a successful mainstream adoption of learning analytics. We're just not there yet. That's true with both the products, but as I said, it's also a challenge at the institution level. You know, we're all in this together is one way to look at it. So that's where we are today. And so now we're trying to look about, well, what's going to happen in the future? I do want to talk a little bit about where we're not going to be seeing the future. This is a chart that I put together back in 2012 when the MOOC craze was hitting its early and massive peak. This was yet another example of how, you know, with the scale of massive open online courses and with the MOOCs coming out, this would finally kill the learning platform, the traditional LMS, but it would also provide massive big data solutions. It's just going to revolutionize how we do teaching and learning. This chart is actually, we're saying, well, for these things to really have legs behind them, they've got four barriers they have to overcome. You know, there's got to be revenue. The whole magic idea of just make these systems grow, but there was no business model behind them. And to take a step back, if you don't mind, one of the great innovations in the LMS industry was coming up with business models and having paying customers so that you could have these platforms work long term. But MOOCs, while there's been a lot of benefits to them, it's not been in terms of let's replace everything. That's not where we're seeing the future, if you will. Yes, we tend to pick on Newton, but Newton that was recently sold really just for assets. This is a company pointing out the promise of artificial intelligence, and they made the statement about we're almost like a robot tutor in the sky that can semi-read your mind and figure out. So basically saying, let the machines do all the thinking for you. This is not working, and as a matter of fact, we're seeing several companies go out of business or be sold off for parts that were based on this. And I should be careful. Is anybody here from George Washington University? Okay. This is from I don't know how many people recognize this. There was a lawsuit by students at George Washington University where they were claiming their online courses were essentially a scam and they need their money back. Part of the lawsuit, I think it was a master's, maybe in cybersecurity. I can't remember the exact thing that it was. This is literally course materials from the program they were taking. People just scanned, and poorly at that, the slides that were used in a face-to-face class, they were just thrown online. And you can see the bullets. I mean, they just say things like updates. There's no context, no text around it. This was their course. And it led to a lawsuit at George Washington University. That's why I'm glad nobody's here from there. But they did a review of their online programs. And what they found is there was no oversight, no knowledge within the institution of how the different programs were working. This is giving a bad name to online education. This is probably about the worst example I've seen, but it's what a lot of people experience with it. So things that are not pointing to the future are sort of the overhype of machine learning, the overhype of MOOCs, or the flat out, let's just throw something online and by having it online, we will have, you know, magic courses. All of these sort of fall prey to what I think the geniuses at South Park described on their flaw. Actually, I should have checked to see if audio works on this. No, it doesn't. If you people know the underpants gnomes, it's a great clip. But basically just saying, hey, people say, we'll just do something magic and then profits at the end. And then there's no understanding of what happens in between. I've got the link. If you have not seen this clip, it's very important to watch that. What's that?
Do you want me to try the link and see if that works?
Nope. Okay. Yeah, I should have tested that out ahead of time. Sorry about that. So where are we? In my opinion, I think that we're in the midst of an inflection point in higher education. We're now into mainstream adoption. A lot of people have been frustrated. It's taken us so long to get here. But there's some important changes that are happening. But we're now in mainstream adoption of digital technology and learning platforms in particular, and online and hybrid class designs. And this is driven by mainstream adoption. We have different platform designs with new capabilities, improving assessment, improving focus on learners, more reliable. And we're moving beyond the digitization of the traditional classroom. So the challenge in the future, and where I think that we're going to be seeing things, is how do you address this inflection point? How, you know, let's not fall for hype, but how do we actually help with richer pedagogical solutions moving forward, but recognizing that we have mainstream adoption and we've got to support a wide variety of users? This is from the Learning House. It's an OPM company, but they online program management. But they put out a survey where they, one of the things I like about them, they're one of the few studies that comes out every year where they survey students and they get student information. And this is looking at online courses. But the point is, from a student, how would you compare the instruction of your college level online learning experiences with your college level classroom experiences? And the vast majority view that online is about the same or even better than face-to-face. So while I showed you the poor example on the George Washington case, what you're seeing is a survey across students. Students understand that they can actually see that. We're getting to a point where if you use the technology right, if you do the right pedagogical design, the right, if you use an effective design, you can do more with technology now than you could do even in a traditional classroom. That's the challenge. How do we do at least as well or even better using these platforms moving forward? Now, this is not a simple case like there's no problem with online, but the promise is there, and how do we need to meet that? This chart is from Educause, where they do their survey, faculty survey of IT system. And it's looking at faculty satisfaction of a group of features around an LMS. So posting content, great, that works fine. You know, doing course assignments and making them available, that works well. But as you go down there, the thing that's been the most disappointing to faculty is engaging in meaningful interactions with students. This is a weakness of systems, but it's also where I expect to see a lot of improvements moving forward. The vendors understand this is a challenge, and so these systems need to find ways either directly or by integrating with third-party platforms to really give better tools for engaging interactions from faculty to students and from students to students. And so a lot of what you'll be seeing in the future is addressing this weakness. Put another way, we're not going to be satisfied with the dreaded threaded discussion board as the primary way of doing doing interactions. There needs to be a whole new set of models moving forward and richer interaction. The other thing is looking at the student as an individual. Unfortunately, you know, I think personalized learning, the idea is great, but it's sort of been taken over by marketing claims where personalized learning means automatic customization of content delivered to students. So something that with no student agency. So we're acknowledging the marketing term is probably usurping the concept, but the idea is how do we deal with students as individuals and give them different learning paths moving forward? And a lot of features are moving this direction. How do you serve this within learning platforms? And a lot of it gets into the area of delivering different content based on what students need and ideally what they can select. But also having, you know, homework time is contact time. Making sure that faculty and course designers and instructional staff can see how students are doing and get some of that feedback so that they have basically using systems as their eyes and ears to see what's happening in the classroom to improve, you know, course designs, or be able to say, this group of students, I need to give them extra help. This is where something's not working. Or it could be feedback saying, hey, something's not clicking. We've got to change the design of the course. This isn't working. And this is a key point, however, when we get to data. And so part of this is me on my soapbox as much as saying, I definitely think this is happening. We need to be looking at data that's usable back to the end user, where the data actually provides insight and makes teachers better, makes students better. Since Game of Thrones is nearing its end, I thought I'd do a chart from Jon Snow. This is a different Jon Snow. And he was in England in the 1800s, and this is based on a cholera outbreak in 1854. At the time, there was sort of the miasma theory of disease. It's bad air, putrid air, humors, that type of thing. He didn't buy into it. There was a cholera outbreak, and he looked at it, and he started talking to people, individuals who lived around this. This is Soho in London. And then he put out this dot map of cholera, where it happened, and it helped visualize the fact that it really got centered, and over time it came from a specific well, a public well that was in the middle of the city. Now, once they started studying this, some of this insight came afterwards. Turns out there was an open cesspit that was a safe distance away from the well, separated by a good 3 feet, with an open pit. Somehow, that didn't help out. But they were, so at the time, they didn't understand germ theory, so they didn't understand the direct, you know, fecal implications of drinking water. But they were able to, by this visualization, help people understand this is not bad air. Something's, it's a tricky situation, just like in learning. It's a lot of variables, but it has something to do with this well. Now, things had already started improving, but the city shut down the well. They took the handle off so that nobody could pump the water anymore, and that helped tame, you know, that no more cholera outbreak after that. This is the concept of what we need to be moving for data in the future. Data that comes back to the end users, teachers and students in particular, and gives them insights and valuable information. Not data that makes the decision for them and takes them out of the role of deciding what to do, but valuable information coming back to the people who are practicing education moving forward. And this is another view of it, and a lot of it gets into formative assessment. We need to have much greater systems where this data can be fed back to the people who can use it, and presented in clear and understandable ways so it's usable information. So one of the greatest things to look forward to in two of the things that I've mentioned right here for the learning platforms in the future, they've got to get much better in supporting initiatives to feeding data back to people so that it's usable, but it's not meant to replace decision making. And this is a blog that gets into why learning in particular, it's one of the biggest dangers is using machine learning around student data. And it's since you can download the slide, I recommend reading this blog because it helps explain the limitations and why we need to focus on data as informing people as opposed to doing machine learning and automatic tracking. One final note that I'll get, we need to have systems, and this also gets into our educational practices, where we're looking at all groups of students. This is looking at the improvement of face-to-face courses versus online courses at the California Community College system and taking that data, and you see they're narrowing the gap. There's always been a problem where online courses have a lower success rate than face-to-face, but with the right initiatives, you can reduce that. I don't have time to show it, but they have a second chart saying this is happening across all ethnic groups and across first generation and later students. A huge part of what we need to focus on moving forward is taking data and taking educational processes and making sure that it's broad-based impacts, that we're not leaving any groups behind. So this is from an MIT report, even though they're one of the people who are very much behind the MOOC craze, this is a very excellent report that they did that is backing up some of these same views, talking about online learning environments, customizing content, and enabling teachers to provide more of direct, what they already know they should be doing, more individual instruction to students and better teaching practices. That's where we are with learning platforms. And the big areas I would look for is improved interaction capabilities, improved data that's actually usable, even though we've been talking about it for a dozen years, and to maintain the integration capabilities. But it takes time, because all the while we have to support both sides of that chasm that we talked about. We have to support the early adopters. We have to support the mainstream. So part of this is to also say, while this is sort of pointing the direction in the future, patience is important in this area. These changes are going to be taking longer than what some people certainly would have hoped moving forward. But that's where we are and why this is somewhat of a unique market and what we can look for moving forward.
So I hope you enjoyed Phil Hill's keynote. Go to my show notes. You can see links to his presentation slides, or you can view them on the YouTube video podcast version of this podcast. Until next time, have a great week.
that's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.